Chapter 34, 24 Steps to Freedom. January, 1970, Orange County, California. Personally, I find everything about courtrooms dreary and unscientific. And this particular jury did not give out promising signals. Orange County is the home of Richard Nixon and the John Birch Society. My 12 peers were sternly conservative in dress and demeanor. The evidence brought against me included the arresting officer's two weather-beaten roaches and a few flakes of marijuana which were vacuumed from the pocket of a jacket found in the front seat of the station wagon. I could have taken the stand and denied possession of the two roaches truthfully and perhaps convincingly. By introducing the seven flakes of marijuana, the state was admitting the flimsiness of the case against me. The jury came back quickly with a verdict. Rosemary, Jack, and I, we were all guilty of the wizard crime, possession. Then the judge pulled a shocker. I was remanded to jail immediately without appeal bond. Unheard of and clearly unconstitutional. The shaved head of His Honor glistened under the fluorescent lights as he quoted from an article I had written for Playboy magazine, ridiculing the marijuana laws. "For you," said the jailer, as the steel doors slammed shut, "we throw away the keys." The next day, I talked with Rosemary in the visiting room, through the glass. She wept. The lawyers were helpless. The judge, basking in community approval, was adamant. It looked like 10 years for two roaches, plus the federal 10, plus the 11 Millbrook counts looming in the future. The trap had snapped shut. I spent 5 weeks in a solitary confinement cell in the Orange County Jail awaiting sentence. My term was set at 10 years maximum. Rosemary and Jack received probation. It was a joy to be transferred to the relative freedom of state prison. In contrast with a county jail, Chino Prison was a glamorous resort with access to a large yard equipped with sunshine, blue sky, and a grassy baseball field. Prisoners were allowed the use of handball courts and weightlifting facilities, plus the precious liberty to visit the library and other cell blocks. Chino functioned as a reception center where new prisoners were tested, interviewed, and classified for transfer to a long-term joint. On the third day, I was ticketed to report to the psychological testing room. The trustee in charge smiled apologetically. "Seems we got a little problem here, Doc. The classification program here is based mainly on psychological tests that you developed." "Oh, that'll teach me to mind my own business," I said. "We have to give you the test, that's the rules." "Okay, let's go." Now, the test of intelligence is to get the highest possible score. My answers to the personality tests were calculated to make me appear normal, non-impulsive, docile, conforming. My vocational tests reveal aptitudes in forestry and farming, together with a hopeless incompetence in clerical tasks. I was angling for a transfer to a minimum security prison where escape might be possible. It was shocking to me to discover in later months that many Americans, indeed many of my liberal friends, were offended when I took the Midnight Express out of prison. Why, they considered escape to be a criminal act, an antisocial act, more heinous than any of my crimes. It just goes to show how separate realities can develop even among friends. But hey, consider my situation. I was a 49-year-old man facing life in prison for encouraging people to face up to new options with courage and intelligence. The American government at that time was being run by Richard Nixon, Spiro Agnew, John Ehrlichman, Robert Haldeman, G. Gordon Liddy, John Mitchell, J. Edgar Hoover, and many other cynical flouters of the democratic process. There was no question in my mind, it was my duty to escape. Would you have let men like these keep you in prison for life for your ideas? Orders soon came down transferring me to the men's colony west at San Luis Obispo. In this minimum security prison, all I had to face was a 15-foot barbed wire fence and gun trucks manned by sharpshooters. I was assigned to work mornings in the captain's office where the custody people could keep their eye on me. Afternoons I devoted to physical exercise in preparation for my escape, weightlifting and workouts in the gym. I was in the best physical shape I'd been in since West Point. After settling into the prison routine and learning who were the snitches to avoid, I sounded out some veteran convicts about escape routes. There was one good possibility. From the second story roof of a cell block near mine, a cable ran above the fence to a telephone pole just outside the compound. Now the floodlights were all mounted below the height of the cable. My advisor thought that a man pulling himself along the cable would be invisible, even to the gun truck stationed about 70 feet away. The problem was that nobody had ever been willing to take the risk. Rosemary and I discussed the plan on the lawn during her Sunday visit. She was to arrange a car to meet me out on the highway near the prison. Members of the Brotherhood were eager to manage the getaway. Other sympathizers offered to provide the outside help, trained criminals who would spirit me out of the country for $25,000. We went along with this tactic because these friends had connections with Cuba and other third world countries where I could receive political asylum. The escape had to be postponed for 5 months. My advisors urged that I wait until the September fogs. One of my convict mentors insisted that I wait until he got paroled, fearing that he'd be blamed if I took the red-eye special. So Rosemary lined up a job for him on the outside to accelerate his parole. Rosemary, by the way, was totally committed to my release, working tirelessly with lawyers, journalists, politicians. She was there every visiting day, bringing messages. One of Rosemary's tasks in preparing for the escape was to pack up our personal belongings at the Berkeley House. The main problem, what to do with the 20 filing cabinets containing my archives from kindergarten to the present. There was some fear that the government might seize both the house and the records. Saturday morning, September 12th, 1970, my cellmate Angelo woke me at 10. I sprang to the window to see soft, gray, lovely clouds, my security blanket. Good weather for a night flight. Angelo complained, "Fucking clouds, we won't be able to see our wives on the lawn tomorrow." I lay in bed shuffling the 24 escape cards. 1, moonless night. 2, fog. 3, a Saturday night. Wait until the parole car returns from the CMC East with the snack bar trustees around 8:30. 4, paint white trim on sneakers black. 5, write farewell note and leave in locker. 6, leave cell block before or after the 9 o'clock break when prisoners flood the hallway. 7, wait until the central court is empty or all prisoners are walking with their back to the side door. 8, slip outside door and walk to the tree, 5 seconds. 9, climb tree, 5 seconds. 10, leap to roof silently. 11, remove sneakers. 12, lie down on roof to check locations of guards and patrol cars. 13, if seen, be prepared to make a desperate break. 14, crawl along the roof of the connecting corridor to cell block 324, 60 seconds. 15, creep to the end of the roof of 324, avoiding the TV antenna wires, 60 seconds. 16, put on sneakers and handball gloves. 17, wrap hands and feet around the cable and pull self across, 90 seconds. 18, slide down pole on the other side of fence, 5 seconds. 19, climb down bank and cross outer perimeter, avoiding barracks. Be alert for the fire watch. to reach highway, 4 minutes. 20. Run half mile north along Highway 1 to turn off with 3 trees, 4 minutes. 21. Wait for a pickup car with right blinker flashing. 22. My contact is Kelly. My name is Nino. 23. Flee the country. 24. Live happily ever after. At 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the sun broke through, but friendly clouds were waiting off the coast. I paced the yard, counting out seconds, rehearsing. 4 minutes to the highway, 4 minutes to the 3 trees. I joined the line for early chow, my last supper on metal plates. Back to the cell block, where I sat in a darkened TV room watching the Stanford-Arkansas football game. I lay in my bunk for the 5 o'clock count. The seconds were moving fast now. The count clear whistle sounded, tramping feet to chow. Combing his hair, Angelo said, coming to dinner? I ate on the early line, I said. Waiting for the cell block to clear. Now, I moved to my locker, ripped white laces from sneakers and re-threaded them brown. Crouched facing the locker, newspaper in my lap. Unscrewed the black paint tube, squished pigment over white striping on sneakers. Steps, jangle of guard keys. Shove shoes back in locker. Waiting, guard gone. Sweaty hands black from smearing pigment on smooth rubber. Put on hand gloves. Brush black on backs. Paint leaking onto hands. Toss gloves in locker to dry and shut door. I scrub my hands with a coarse bristle brush and mop paint off the floor with a towel. I stowed the towel and the brush under the mattress. The count clear whistle sounded again at 8:30. Angelo split to play bridge. Now, put on black sneakers, dark blue denim jacket, eyeglasses. I shoved her letters, prison ID, and meditation beads in pocket. Now, it was time. I walked to the end of the cell block, out to the corridor, praying the coast was clear. Uh-oh, 2 cons watched me pass. I went up the hallway and U-turned back. They were still watching me. I went on beyond them, around the corner casually, and made a pass through a neighboring cell block. I stood indecisive. I'm trapped. The clock is moving. Have to hurry or I'll miss the highway pickup. It's suspicious standing. Down the hall again. Looked left. God damn it. 2 cons still there. Kept moving along the side corridor. Circle back. Time is wasting. Hit corner. They're gone. Moved towards side door. Looked right. Inside the cell block, 3 cons were talking. Shit. One is Metcalf, a snitch. They felt my hesitation. They looked up. I walked on. U-turn. I gotta bluff it through. If I move smoothly to the door, maybe I'll be invisible. At the last second, before reaching the door handle, I flicked a glance to the cell block. 3 heads turned to look. Shit. I walked past the side door. Blew it. Should have slipped through. I turned north. There's another door to the exercise yard down the corridor. I would have to walk across the yard. Walk across the yard. At night? Hey, it's strictly off limits. If seen, they'll sound the alarm. I took a deep breath and opened the door and walked onto the prison yard, lit by floodlights. No one walks the yard in the dead of night, not even the guards. I stood in front of the tree, directly in front of a window. God damn it. Inside, facing the window, is Metcalf, braying at 2 cons. How can I climb the tree 2 feet in front of a snitch? I sat on the steps. I was exposed by the spotlight. If a guard saw me, I'd get my ass busted with blackened handball gloves in my pocket and farewell notes in my locker. Time froze. I watched the glistening leaves and listened to the muffled sounds of Metcalf's voice. Well, it was now or never. Now, I walked to the tree. I'd have to climb right in front of Metcalf. So what? It would take a few minutes to sound the alarm and another 5 minutes for the two-man gun trucks to get on the road. Metcalf's voice boomed goodnight. He turned away from the window. Then, my neurology shifted into some ancient, dreamy survival pattern. I grabbed a branch, wrapped a foot around it, swung upward, foot, hand, balanced on a drooping branch, leaned across the void, and dropped 4 foot onto the roof of the connecting corridor. I sat quietly on the tar paper slant, listening to voices and the trampling in the hallway below. Now I could look over the entire prison, across to the custody office where guards were lounging. In the shadows, above the searchlights, I was a forest creature scanning the camp of humans. I crept along the roof to the end of the corridor, climbed up the ridge and down to the roof of 324. I bumped into the TV antenna wires. I froze. I could look down on either side into neighboring cell blocks. My silhouette was exposed against the sky. At the end of the roof, I could see over the fence to lights on the highway below. I pulled on the handball gloves and lay on the angled roof just under the cable. I hooked my ankles over the wire, reached up my hands, and pulled out head first. It was hard going. Every 10 inches, there was a loop that held the telephone cord below the cable. My legs bumped and tangled in the cord. Easy, sweeping pulls were impossible. I had to reach, then wrench 10 inches. Hands out. Pull body. Haul legs. 10 inches. The cable bounced and swung. It was a strain to hang on. Weird wrestling motions, my body swinging, clinging to the swaying wire. Sweating, heaving awkwardly. After 50 pulls, a pause. Horrid discovery. I was completely exhausted. Lungs gasping, arms drained, body limp and weak. I can't go another foot. I'm only one-third across the wire. I haven't even reached the road. Exhausted. My hands can't hold the weight of my body. With desperate sexual writhing, I embraced the cable with my elbows and knees and rested. The cable swinging slowed. Then came the nightmare thoughts. Well, what are you doing this time, Professor? Inefficient wizard dangling 20 feet high in full view of two gun trucks. I would say that once again, the little experiment has gotten out of hand, Professor. The interior light snapped on in the nearest gun truck. Uh-oh, he's seen me. He's gonna put out the light now to sound the alarm. The word is flashing. I waited for patrol cars to scream up. Would they poke me down like a wild raccoon with sticks? I squirmed forward again. 5 more wrenching feet. Stop. Wrists and arms exhausted. Panting. God damn it, I should have quit smoking. I should have pumped more iron. It had seemed so easy. Well, now I knew why no cons had escaped this way. It was fucking Olympic gymnastics up there in the high wire on the gun sights. I should have waited until the winter fog. Maybe the cable strung temptingly over the fence was a trap. Maybe the hunters were waiting in trucks. Rifles cradled on knees. With a desperate lunge, I pulled my body along in clumsy crab motions. I stopped to rest. I could look back down into rooms where cons were watching television. A sudden glare of light. 40 feet away, a patrol car turned from the compound road towards me. Shit, I'm caught. The car rolled closer, crunching gravel. My denim arms turned lavender in the headlight. The driver leaned over to crush a cigarette in the ashtray. The car passed under me and disappeared. Now, I tumbled into some sort of delirium. Arms crossed, I inched along the wire like a caterpillar, my mind fixed on reaching the fence so I'd fall to freedom outside the perimeter. My hand kept getting tangled in the phone wire loops. A compulsive wrench to free my hand set the cable bouncing wildly. Mouth gasping, face bulging, glasses dripping, sweat twisted, I wanted Errol Flynn, and out came Harold Lloyd. I felt very alone. 49 years and 325 days of my life built up to this ordeal. There was no fear, only a nagging embarrassment. Such an undignified way to die, nailed like a sloth on a branch. Hey, no more thoughts. From some inner reservoir came live, survive, a flow of energy and a curious erotic lightness. Neck arching, shoulders thrusting, body wiggling, legs kicking, shoulders pushing, propelled by uterine squeeze. My glasses fell, but my arms smoothly reeled cable. Thus I budded, head first, sweating, wet, into a new life. Hand over hand till my fingers hit the pole. Hanging by my legs, I practiced it 1,000 times in my bunk. I reached and grabbed the spike on the pole, dropped my body, wrapped legs round the splintery wood, slid down, down. My exultant feet hit liberated ground. Free!